This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's been nearly 10 years since a white supremacist gunman entered the Sikh temple of Wisconsin and fatally shot 6 people. Sadly, the decade since then has seen more attacks on houses of worship, from a church in South Carolina to the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. As Rob Mentzer reports, for some members of the Sikh temple, that makes this an even more difficult anniversary.
Satwan Singh Kalika brought his wife and 2 sons to Milwaukee from the Punjab region of India in 1982. He'd been a farmer in India. In America, he worked in a factory and later started a full-service gas station. By 2012, the Milwaukee area was his home. He was president of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin. That August, his son Pardeep Kalika had a chance to reflect on just how far his dad had come.
August 3rd was my birthday. It was the last time that I would see I didn't know it at the time, but the last time I would see my father alive.
On August 5th, when a gunman entered the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Satwan Kalika was one of the 6 people killed. A 7th, who was paralyzed in the shooting, would die from his injuries in 2020. A police roadblock stopped Pardeep Kalika and his young family on their way to the temple that day. He waited all day for word about his father.
My father would do anything and everything to make it back to his community, to his family. He was the most determined man I've ever seen. And so by the end of the day, I knew before they ever made notification that he was probably one of the people that died inside.
The gunman exchanged fire with 2 officers who arrived within minutes of a 911 call from the temple. He then fatally shot himself. This week, the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin will mark the 10th anniversary of the shootings with a 48-hour prayer. They'll hold community education events and, on Friday evening, a candlelight vigil. Sikh temples across the country will hold community service events of their own. It's a somber anniversary, but for some, it's also frustrating. The last decade has seen a rise in mass shootings, including high-profile terror attacks on places of worship, some by white supremacists. Anisha Singh is the executive director of the nonprofit Sikh Coalition.
Oak Creek can be seen as that warning of an increasingly violent and assertive role that white supremacy was set to play in American society over the next decade.
But if so, she says, it was a warning that wasn't heeded. At a Wednesday evening service, priests and Gurdwara members read prayers. In the next room, volunteers prepare a meal. Families sit on the floor to eat, a symbol of humility and equality. Navi Gill was 18 when the shooting happened. In a library room at the temple, he shows a visitor photos of the victims of the 2012 attack.
These are the images of the 6 people that were lost. Sita Singh and Ranjit Singh were brothers.
Today, Gill is going to medical school. His life and the world have changed a lot. But when he thinks of the shooting...
Sometimes it feels like it was yesterday. Like, some of the memories are so vivid. It feels like, you know, it just happened. And then you realize, no, like, these people have been out of our lives for 10 years. And you miss them.
The man who opened fire in Oak Creek was named Wade Page. He didn't leave a manifesto or a trail of writings online, but he was an active member of hate groups, and investigators say he probably targeted the Sikh temple because its members are visibly different, mostly brown-skinned, some wearing turbans. Today, Kalika's main work is doing therapy for people who've been captured by extremist ideologies. He's worked with former white supremacists, Islamists, and even eco-terrorists.
Why I do this work is because I think as a society, we do not get upstream enough. And I'm trying to prevent the next Wade Page out there from hurting any community.
Still, he says, it's hard not to feel discouraged. With radical ideologies spreading and the easy availability of guns, Kalika says he fears things are going to get worse before they get better. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Congress has seen a flurry of activity lately, with Democratic leaders negotiating with Republicans in some cases and members of their own party in others on a variety of bills. Senate Democrats Chuck Schumer and Joe Manchin reached a deal on reviving a reconciliation package that includes key spending to fight climate change, among other things. Schumer says he plans to call another vote on the PACT Act, which aims to provide health care to veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. And there's been bipartisan support in the passage of the CHIPS Act, aimed at boosting semiconductor production to compete with China. We're catching up on all the moving parts on these bills, some of the politics behind them, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these bills in Congress? Do you want to see Democrats pass something, maybe not the full Build Back Better bill that fell by the wayside, but something on climate change, Medicare price negotiations, and more? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Elena Treen is a congressional reporter at Axios. She's a co-author of the weekly Axios Sneak Peek newsletter and covers Capitol Hill, the Biden administration, and elections. Elena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this sort of, I think, surprise to a lot of people, including congressional Democrats. It's called, the Democrats are calling it the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, kind of the descendant of the Build Back Better plan that didn't end up passing. Can you tell us what is in this? What's the scope of it?
Yes. Yeah, so big news on Capitol Hill, dropped last week by Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Chuck Schumer, who had been negotiating this really in secret and in private. They didn't bring in, as you mentioned, really any other Senate Democrats to be involved in these talks. And Manchin says that's because he wasn't sure if they would fail or they'd fall apart. But now it's proving to potentially complicate negotiations and, you know, a final potential passage of this bill. The total price tag of this is $739 billion, which is far less than the $3.5 trillion that had been floated most of last year as Democrats were working toward what was then called the Build Back Better package on climate change and a lot of the more ambitious and progressive priorities of the Biden administration. This bill, the much more smaller deal, like I said, $739 billion, a good chunk of that will go toward a 15% corporate minimum tax, which is what some Democrats, particularly Joe Manchin, is calling just closing the loophole, less of a, you know, raising taxes on corporations, but more so closing loopholes that exist already. $288 billion will go toward prescription drug pricing reform, something that many Democrats have been really eager to pass, but have really failed to do so in the past several years. There is also IRS tax enforcement in there. There's $14 billion for the carried interest loophole. Another good chunk of money for energy security and climate change, and about $64 billion for expansion of the Affordable Care Act. And so those are the main components here. And like I said, it's a much slimmer and narrow focus package compared to what Democrats had initially been pushing for, but really the most realistic thing that they can get done, particularly as we come up against the November midterm elections.
Okay, procedure-wise, this is, as you mentioned, it's the R word, reconciliation, this thing
yes.
that a party can do a couple times a year. It's a little tricky, but it lets them get past the filibuster. So they could do it with their majority, which is 50 plus a vice president. All Democrats presumably need to be on board with this. Doesn't seem likely to get Republican support. What are the big question marks there when it comes to getting all 50 Democrats in the Senate on board with this thing?
Well, there's a few hiccups that I think are being ironed out as we speak. The biggest one is Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who has really been, I mean, if you look at negotiations over the past year and a half or so of the Biden administration, Senator Sinema and Manchin have always been the two that have stood in the way of a potential reconciliation deal. Again, what would need only a simple majority in the Senate. Manchin is on board because he's been the one who's negotiating this, but they've left Sinema out of the process, which has raised some alarm bells, I think. And I think they, you know, her team has told me and other reporters that really she was blindsided by the announcement of this deal last week. I think we're going to see more come of that in the next several days. Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, said that he wants to have a vote on this by the end of the week. The Senate is supposed to break by the end of this week to go on their August recess, not returning until early September. So they're really racing against the clock to get this done. I suspect that they'll probably extend their session a couple days longer to iron this out. But getting Senator Sinema on board will be huge. Joe Manchin plans to speak with her on the Senate floor this evening. We'll see if that, you know, goes anywhere. But also her team has been saying that she really wants to see the sentiment parliamentarian. Again, this is all very in the weeds, I know, but really to get any kind of deal like this through the reconciliation process, which is a budget process in the Senate, you need it to pass what's called the Byrd rule, which is really ensuring that all of these priorities and the provisions in the broader bill are in line with that whole process for a budget reconciliation package. So Sinema is one big obstacle. Another obstacle, I'd say, are some moderate Democrats, particularly those in the tri-state area like New Jersey, who have really been talking about wanting, if they're going to have any sort of bill that deals with taxes, they want it to eliminate the SALT tax, the state and local tax provision. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey has said that he takes issue that this bill doesn't address SALT, but from the conversations that I've been having with some of these moderate Democrats who care deeply about that issue, it doesn't seem like they're going to hold up the package because of that. And so it really does look like they're on track to get this done, but they do still need to get a couple more things ironed out and particular senators on board to make sure that this passes. Like I said, they want it by the end of the week.
We're talking to Axios congressional reporter Elena Treen about bills working their way through Congress right now. We've been talking about this, what's being called the Inflation Reduction Act, a Democratic effort to do some climate change funding, make some changes to tax policy, allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, and more. Other bills out there, this chip production bill that's gone to President Biden for his signature, a holdup on a veterans health bill as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on any or all of those. If you want to see Democrats accomplish this climate change and other stuff legislation this year, this election year, what about this bill aimed at boosting chip, microchip production here in the United States, trying to boost the technology industry, reduce dependence on China? And have you been following the drama over this bill to fund healthcare for veterans exposed to burn pits? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Elena Treen, congressional reporter at Axios, with us today to share the latest on bills in Congress, including climate change efforts, computer chip production, and health care for veterans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Your thoughts on any of this rush in Congress, this last-minute drama before they go to their August recess? The number is 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Jim is with us in Bayfield County. Jim, hi.
Oh, hello. Thanks for letting me talk for a second. I'm a veteran of Vietnam, and I've been concerned about this burn pit bill because I've been in mental health treatment with the VA, and there's I noticed quite a few guys claiming a disability through the burn pit. I do not think that the science is there. 3.2 million American veterans are going to claim they've been exposed to burn pit thing, and it's I think it's bogus. I know that it's not very popular what I say, but I sincerely think it's true. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for the call. Elena, Jim referring to this bill in Congress. Remind us what this, it's called the PACT Act, I believe, was intended to do.
Yes, that's right. And it faced some controversy last week, but it looks like it will likely pass. The PACT Act stands for the Promise to Address Comprehensive Toxics Act. And essentially, it's a sweeping military toxic exposure legislation. And the call is very right. A lot of people referring to it as a burn pit bill. And it's supposed to benefit millions of American veterans. The controversy around this bill, it's funny, and it's very typical with how things work here in Washington. It got caught up and kind of hung up over things that didn't have to do with the bill. I think Republicans for a long time have supported this measure. And then late last week, when talks of this reconciliation bill about with Democrats negotiating it being far bigger than Republicans expected it to include climate change and other provisions, they decided that maybe we don't want to vote on this, and they voted against it and held it up because of those negotiations. But in light of that, a lot of people, including John Stewart and other veterans, have really, you know, spanned the airwaves in the days since that, saying that they need to vote for this and this is a very important bill. And it looks like now it's headed for a procedural vote in the Senate tonight, Monday night, and it'll likely get the 60 votes for it to move forward. And if it does do that, it's very much expected that it will pass and be signed into law by President Joe Biden a few days after that. And so it is on track, I think, to pass. And it looks like Republicans have since kind of dropped their refusal to hold this up, their intentions to hold this up. And so it looks like it's on track, but definitely a bill that I think many veterans, including the caller, are worried about, and rightfully so.
And the objection from Republicans, the stated objection anyway, wasn't to the content of the bill itself, as I understand it, but to how it was paid for, or I guess they argue not paid for. Is that what they were mostly pointing toward?
Yes. I mean, one of the mostly, I think that's where the Republican opposition came in. There's also been some concern over how some of the benefits in the bill will be classified in federal budgeting procedures. One of them is about, you know, whether the funding for this bill, which will be spanned out over the next several years, whether that should be mandatory or something that's voted on consecutively each year moving forward. That's something that Senator Pat Toomey, a Republican from Pennsylvania, has really pushed for, and his amendment to do, you know, to limit whether, you know, not have it be a permanent funding measure, but rather something that's voted on year to year. That's something that the majority leader, Chuck Schumer, is expected to attach in an amendment today. And so if that's voted on, Toomey said that he expects a vote for the bill. I think other Republicans are kind of happy with just having the vote itself. But most, by and large, I think it was kind of opposition to other things that Democrats are doing and not necessarily the contents of this bill itself.
Talking to Elena Treen, congressional reporter at Axios, looking at a flurry of activity in Congress running up to the August recess. Elena, I also mentioned this CHIP Act aimed at boosting microchip production in the United States. Some questions about it as it went into the House after getting some bipartisan support in the Senate ended up passing. Again, remind us a bit of what this bill would do and the politics that ultimately sent it to President Biden for a signature.
Yeah, so the CHIPS bill was huge. And it's something that, again, another one of those bills that has had many different names. And this time it's really focusing on the chip manufacturing and still, though, has a lot of ties to China. It's something that initially was called USICA, and something that a bipartisan group of senators passed over a year ago now. And there was a lot of controversy over the size and scope of the bill, but really it's kind of continued to maintain a lot of the same provisions that the initial bill had. It's going to be roughly $250 to $280 billion for the manufacturing industry and for technology and science programs. Funding for the National Science Foundation is a huge part of the bill. And it really is to help set up America to better compete with China. It also addresses a lot of the supply chain issues that I think we've seen in the United States over the past year or so, affected by COVID, also in part affected by current inflation, as we're seeing. And so a bill that really a lot of people said was necessary, not only to help the manufacturing industry, but also a national security bill to better position the United States against China.
Briefly, the House also passed an assault weapons ban, an effort to bring back some kind of assault weapons ban. This is on Friday. Now, in the Senate, this one would need 60 votes. That seems like a tall order.
Yes, it's almost guaranteed it will fail in the Senate. I just don't think that there's enough Republicans to get that over the 60 vote threshold that is needed to break the filibuster. And this is a conversation that also came up in light of the massacre in Buffalo, and then again in Texas with the Uvalde shooting. There's a reason it didn't. I mean, the Senate and the House, you know, Congress, and it was passed into law, a bipartisan gun safety bill. There's a reason that the senators who negotiated this bill did not include a ban on assault rifles or assault weapons in that bill, because it was just, it was known that they would not get enough support to pass. And so while the House has a lot of a much bigger, Democratic majority where they were able to pass this, it really was seen as a messaging bill more so, and not something that would be passed into law.
A lot going on in Congress this week. What are you watching for next in the, I guess, hours and days to come?
Well, we talked about a lot of it. I think, you know, the PACT Act will be huge. It's something that a lot of people would expect to pass quite easily and had some hiccups, but I do expect it'll pass this week. And it's a very important bill for veterans. And so that is on track. And reconciliation is going to be massive. It's something that I think took up really most of the oxygen on Capitol Hill for almost all of last year, particularly the latter half of last year, until we saw Senator Joe Manchin kind of shoot it down. Now that there's a deal and they're headed toward potentially putting the bill on the floor as early as the end of this week, everything is going to be on that. And they only have a couple days left before they break for recess. And I know that really the momentum on Capitol Hill, particularly on the Democratic side, is going to be fully focused on getting that reconciliation bill passed. And it's interesting, I think that with this bill, with the CHIPS bill, with the PACT Act passing, and then that bipartisan gun safety bill I just mentioned, these are all things that Democrats are really eager to go home over recess all throughout August and also in September and October before the midterms and campaign on and show that they have been doing things in Washington, D.C. and trying to deliver wins for the party. It's something that really they're desperate for right now because they're, you know, President Biden is really lagging in the polls in a way that is really disappointing to a lot of Democrats, and they need these wins. And so I think all eyes will be on the few more bills that they can get done now. And I also just want to note, I think, you know, once they come back from their recess in September, really, they don't have a lot of time to get any other major legislation done. So what we see happen in the next few days is really going to be what we can expect Congress to be passing on a large scale before the November midterm elections.
Elena, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Elena Treen is a congressional reporter at Axios. She was with us today to bring us the latest on a variety of bills in Congress, including climate change, veterans' health care, and computer chip production. Democrats trying to get a lot of these bills passed, as we heard, as time is running out leading up to the August recess, and then, of course, the midterm elections coming up in November. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, why do pets do the things that they do? Join the conversation on pet behavior with a couple of experts, and you can call in and share your stories and maybe your questions about your pets and their behavior. That's tomorrow morning at 8. Check it out here on the Ideas Network. I had my first sweet corn of the season over the weekend. I always like fresh sweet corn every year, but I was especially excited for it this year, maybe because it came up on a Food Friday a few weeks back. So Saturday, I was going to grill for people, and I had my heart set on grilled corn on the cob. Just one problem, finding the corn. I had seen some at a farmer's market earlier in the week, so I knew it was out there. I didn't buy it then because I would have had to lug it around all day. Anyhow, Saturday morning, I go by a couple farm stands where I know they usually have corn, but neither of them are open that day for some reason. I'll spare you the dramatic tension. I did find some Wisconsin sweet corn at a grocery store for a good price, too. Soaked it for a while, hit the grill, and yes, it was everything I had been hoping for. I even have a few ears left over to make some street corn, maybe tonight. I want to hear from you. Have you had your first fresh sweet corn of the season? Grilled? Boiled? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Throw us some talk of a Food Friday on corn, so watch this space. This is Central Time.
Connected with the whole state thanks to its network of 7 bureaus. With reporters on the ground across Wisconsin, WPR provides a new service that connects with issues that matter to your life. Stay in touch with WPR.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a discrepancy between state and federal laws creating confusion over the rules for mail-in voting in Wisconsin for voters with disabilities. Absentee voting is underway for next Tuesday's primary elections. We'll talk to an advocate about what voters with disabilities need to know for voting in the midterms this year. Now, if all goes according to plan, there will be a new village of tiny homes completed in Oshkosh by this time next year. The residents, families with children struggling with homelessness. The village is a new project from the Oshkosh Kids Foundation. Julie Dumke is the foundation's co-founder and executive director. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Let's talk.
here.
Yeah, let's talk about the need you're trying to address here. How big a problem is there with families struggling with homelessness in the Oshkosh area?
Well, about over the last 7 years, Oshkosh Area School District has averaged about anywhere from 175 to 220 homeless children. And Oshkosh Kids Foundation, we've been in existence since 2019 and personally have housed 451 children struggling with homelessness at that time, during that time.
What have you been doing to house people before we get into these this new project? How have you housed people?
Currently, we have put families into motels or we help pay security deposits if that's the issue or they can't have, because many places have, you have to pay first month's rent, last month's rent, and a security deposit, and the families just can't swing that. Or we will help with rental assistance if they're on the verge of being evicted.
Can you talk about how disruptive it is for a kid to, you know, literally not know where they're going home after school?
Well, I was in the public education for 34 years and saw a trend of more and more kids coming to school daily, not having showered for a week on end, you know, falling asleep in class, and started to wonder what was going on and started talking to them and realizing maybe the science you were teaching wasn't that important because this child was just worrying about where he was going to sleep that night. And a lot of times people don't think that kids are homeless because they don't see them, you know, sleeping under a bridge or in a park, but they're sleeping in cars. They're sleeping on different friends' couches. Often families are separated between two or three houses. So children have a place, a roof over their head, but it's not a secure and stable or safe environment for them.
That takes us to this village of tiny houses. Tell us what's in the works.
Oh, very excited. Thanks to a local donor, we'll be creating 32 tiny houses that'll be solar powered. Complete amenities, very high tech and nicely made. And with that, we have a community center. So not only will families have a place to live, but they will have services to help them work through whatever got them into a homeless situation, whether that was financial planning, evictions, lack of employability, whatever it is that got them there.
And how long will families be able to stay?
Families will be with us anywhere from 6 to 18 months. During that time frame, the only requirement will be that they have to take part in programming. And then after 18 months, we're using what's called tenant-based rent assistance. And our hope is that they will go into the rental market or perhaps a Habitat for Humanity home. And then we'll have 6 months of tenant-based rental assistance and a caseworker still working with them, so they kind of have a soft landing back into the world.
And what's the construction and move-in timeline?
The construction right now, we just started the community center. The walls were up today. I was super excited when I drove by. So our hope is that will be done as of December 1st. First families moving in about December 15th. We're doing this in phases because we want to make sure that the tiny houses are a right fit, you know, and everything works according to how we planned. And then second phase will probably be April 1st with our goal of everyone, all 32 houses being up and occupied by June 1st next year.
And what was the inspiration for doing this method in particular, of building this village of small houses?
Well, first of all, when we put a family in a hotel, basically we can give them a roof over their head and we could make sure the kids were going to school, but that was all we could do. And we really weren't seeing change for these families. So we felt that, you know, having the wraparound services and the partnership between, we're working with Advocat, the schools, you know, all the social service organizations in our area, that would help move the needle for these families. And about 60% of our families don't have vehicles and rely on public transportation, and our buses don't run after 5:30 or on Sundays. So it made it really difficult for families to have work second shift or get around to go to different service agencies. So we're hoping by having them on site, that'll really help the families, you know, move forward faster.
And I may be getting ahead of things, but are you hoping that once this is up and running, it can be an inspiration for other communities in the state?
Absolutely. Because when we looked at doing this, you know, we looked at like apartment buildings and different things, and we found this to be a very economical cost. A lot of bang for our buck, actually, you know, for the cost to build the project. And what we've also found is that walls, ceilings, and floors cause problems. And by having each family having their own house, they're going to have that pride in home ownership and learn how to be a good tenant and then go out and then, you know, be able to hopefully be successful in the rest of the world.
Julie, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Julie Dumke is co-founder and executive director of the Oshkosh Kids Foundation. She talked with us about a new project to help families struggling with homelessness in the area that'll provide temporary housing in a planned village of tiny houses. To learn more, we've got a link up on our website at wpr.org/centraltime, or you can go straight to oshkoshkids.org/tinyhousevillage. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about being pregnant during the pandemic.
Over the last several years, many profound experiences that typically would be shared with loved ones were lost in the pandemic. Rachel Poston of Milwaukee experienced this when her husband wasn't allowed to come to any of her appointments during her pregnancy. Poston shares her story as part of the Pandemic Pregnancy Project, which is documenting the stories of families and their babies and how they've been affected by COVID-19.
We had a Zoom meeting with our friend group, and one of them was pregnant. And she's not feeling a connection because she's not showing yet and doesn't feel any movement. My husband was saying that he understood because he didn't feel that connection with our pregnancy. It really made me think. During my entire pregnancy in Milwaukee County at my clinic, I couldn't have a guest at any of my appointments. Disappointment is an understatement. I lost that opportunity to have that bond with my husband, experiencing these new milestones in our pregnancy, especially to hear her heartbeat. When he was not allowed in, it was isolating for him a little bit. So his perspective on my friend's lack of connection to her pregnancy didn't surprise me. He saw the anatomy scan through a very blurry FaceTime. The realization that I'm here in a clinic with only the ultrasound tech, hearing that I'm having a girl for the first time and we both wanted a girl, and being alone with a stranger. There were moments when it didn't feel as real as it could or complete. He and I got jealous because we heard of other people's partners being able to go to their appointments because they were at a different hospital or a different county with different restrictions. We were told that maybe if we went to another county, maybe my partner could come with me. Or even in Milwaukee, just switch OBs to a different hospital or a different network. It's like, why do I want to give up this OB who's known me for years, who I trust, who I love? Things are looking up. I'm at 30 weeks, although COVID is still rampant, and my OB tells me that my husband can go to the growth scan after I've already scheduled it. I didn't know this when I scheduled the growth scan. Maybe the schedulers forgot to tell me. They assumed I knew the rules had changed. After my OB tells me this, I call the schedulers to make sure this change was correct, because I don't want to bring my partner all the way downtown to find out he can't go inside. So I call and tell me, no, the rules changed, he can't come in. He could have come to your first ultrasound. When was your first ultrasound? My first ultrasound was in October, to which she says, oh no, he wouldn't have been allowed to come then. The rules have changed so much. I know these changes were out of their hand. It's like, why are you telling a pregnant woman who's coming in at 30 weeks that her husband could have been there for the first ultrasound, then to take it back, then to say he still can't come, and expect me to feel emotionally okay about this back and forth, given the circumstances are also out of my hands as well. I sat in a waiting room, I called my husband, and I told him, you can't come. He says, oh, it's fine, it's fine, it's not a big deal, it's not a big deal. I haven't been there for all of them. And I say a lot of different things, and finally knowing this conversation won't bring him, I cry. I'm sitting in the waiting room, waiting to go in for an ultrasound, and I see a couple come out, a wife and husband, going on their way. I remind myself, it's probably their first ultrasound. The rules have changed. That's great that he can go, that someone else can experience what I wasn't allowed to. My husband did get to hear her when I had a false alarm and thought my water broke. So at least for the final big moments, we made it work. The world continues. When our daughter was born, he was there when he put her on my chest, and I just looked at her and said, you're going to be one bad. And my OB was shocked. I'm a part of reclaiming that word. And my husband was there to witness this moment. And after I'd done this amazing thing of giving birth, we felt bad.
Rachel Poston of Milwaukee shared her story of being pregnant during the pandemic. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a disability rights advocate joins the show to talk about what voters with disabilities need to know for voting in this year's midterms. That comes after an apparent conflict between state and federal law has created uncertainty about voting protections for thousands of disabled voters in the state. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, absentee voting is already underway for next Tuesday's primaries. But after a state Supreme Court ruling last month, there's some confusion over voting rules that impact voters with disabilities. Last month, the state Supreme Court ruled that ballots being dropped off to a clerk's office in person have to be delivered by the voter. But the court declined to say whether someone else could place an absentee ballot in the mail on a voter's behalf. After the ruling, Wisconsin Elections Commission Administrator Megan Wolf went further, saying, at least according to state law, even mail-in ballots should be mailed by voters themselves. Disability Rights Wisconsin says federal law protects disabled voters' rights to get help mailing in their ballot, and those laws remain unchanged. Barbara Beckert is Director of External Advocacy at Disability Rights Wisconsin. Barbara, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Great to be here with you today.
After that state Supreme Court ruling last month, I understand your group got a lot of questions from voters with disabilities. Is there some confusion out there right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is quite a bit of confusion, and we appreciate having the opportunity to talk with you today to try and clarify some of those questions.
Let's break it down one kind of voting at a time. First, mailing in absentee ballots. What do voters with disabilities need to know about the law?
Well, I think the first statement I'd like to make is that the recent ruling by our state Supreme Court did not limit or alter federal laws that protect the rights of voters with disabilities. Those rights are protected by Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, as well as by Section 208 of the Voting Rights Act. So practically speaking, what does that mean to a voter with a disability? First of all, if you need assistance placing your ballot in the mailbox because of disability, you should feel comfortable getting assistance from a person of your choice. So that's pretty clear and straightforward. However, it gets a little bit more complicated if you're a voter with a disability who needs assistance mailing their ballot. So first and foremost, we would encourage people, if you're voting absentee, we hope you've already mailed your ballot by now. If you haven't, right now it's just a little bit over a week out from the election. Postal service can be unreliable. They tell you allow at least a week for returning your ballot. So if you haven't mailed it at this point, you may be taking a chance if you place it in the mailbox. If you are able to return your ballot yourself in person to your clerk or your polling place, we would encourage you to consider doing so. But we hear from voters who have a disability that makes it difficult or impossible for them to personally return that ballot. So we do have some detailed directions that I can share with you as to how they can request a disability-related accommodation from their clerk.
Yeah, how would someone do that in that situation?
Yeah, I'll just run through that with you. And I think that you also have provided the link to our website where we have a little more of the detail. And I'm sorry to say that, you know, it is a little bit of a process. So it's so helpful to have that link for people to check. So first, we're suggesting to the voter that they do contact their clerk and request that disability-related accommodation. Let them know because of disability, they need someone else to deliver their ballot. And we've printed a sample accommodation request that's available on our website. So you can just read that to your clerk You know, that gives you the confidence. So, you know, you're asking for the right thing. Then what we would encourage people to do is to, if you have a printer, print out that request. If you don't, write it out by hand to make that request in writing and make sure it includes your name and the name of the person who you've asked to deliver your ballot. And that person can be an individual of your choice. However, it should not be your employer, your labor union representative, or a candidate who's on the ballot. And then you should give that along with your completed sealed ballot to the person who's going to deliver that ballot for you. And we strongly recommend that you keep a copy of your accommodation request, keep good records. So if you have a smartphone or you know someone who does, just take a picture of that. And then you have that for future reference. And then the person of your choice would then return the ballot along with the accommodation request to your clerk.
We do have a link at WPR.org/centraltime to that information. Talking to Barbara Becker, Director of External Advocacy at Disability Rights Wisconsin, looking at voters with disabilities in the state and what they need to know leading up to next week's election, a midterm primary election, and the election in November. Now, Barbara, that procedure you just gave, people who are following the news in this situation might say, well, wait a minute, the state Supreme Court says voters have to bring their own ballots for in-person and might worry, am I really legally allowed to have that accommodation made? What would you say to them?
That's a good question. Again, our response at Disability Rights Wisconsin would be that that ruling from our state Supreme Court did not in any way limit or alter the federal laws that protect the rights of voters with disabilities. So it's important for people to go through the proper process to request an accommodation. If you need assistance, give us a call at our voter hotline. We're available every day and happy to assist. And if you are denied an accommodation, it's possible that could happen. We would like to know about that, and we can assist you then in filing a formal complaint, because it's important that people know their rights and assert their rights. And we're here to help support them in that process.
Now, a group of Wisconsin voters with disabilities recently filed a lawsuit over some of these issues. Now, Disability Rights Wisconsin is not involved in this lawsuit, but what is your understanding of this suit and what it could mean?
Yeah, this is a suit that includes four voters with disabilities as parties. And these are voters who, because of their disability, are not able to either place their ballot in the mailbox or potentially to return it to their clerk in another way. We think this is a really important suit because voters with disabilities deserve clarification. At DRW, we are confident that those voters have bedrock protections, civil right protections for their right to vote in federal law. And that includes reasonable accommodations at their polling place and assistance from a third party. But it's been thrown into question both by the state Supreme Court and also from some comments from our state elections commission. And that has caused confusion and uncertainty. So that's why this suit is important, to resolve that uncertainty so that voters with disabilities are confident in their right to ask for and receive an accommodation.
Do you think we need changes in the state, whether it comes from the Elections Commission or the legislature or the courts, to make sure that procedures for voters with disabilities line up with their federal rights?
Yes, I certainly think that there are some opportunities for improvement there. And at Disability Rights Wisconsin, as well as the Wisconsin Disability Vote Coalition, which we help to coordinate, we do have a number of recommendations for policymakers that we believe would help to clarify and better align our state policies with federal law, and also make some additional enhancements to ensure that our elections are accessible and inclusive of all voters with disabilities.
In our last less than a minute now, Barbara, can you leave us with a message maybe for voters with disabilities on making sure that they can vote if they want to next week and beyond.
Yeah, we would encourage all voters with disabilities. You have an important perspective. You should make your voice heard and participate in the August and November elections. And honestly, for most voters, if you vote in person, if you vote absentee and are able to mail your own ballot, nothing has changed. It's a smaller number of voters who need to be concerned about these accommodations. But for all voters with disabilities, we encourage know your rights, know the accommodations that you are legally entitled to, and please give us a call at DRW if you have any questions.
Barbara, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Barbara Beckert, Director of External Advocacy at Disability Rights Wisconsin, with us today to talk about what voters with disabilities need to know for voting in this year's midterm elections. Absentee voting is underway in the primaries. In-person voting ends on Tuesday, August 9th. You can find more information at disabilityvote.org. We also have that linked at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, human brains, they're complicated and each one is unique. Explore the mysteries that go on in our heads with the author of the new book, The Neuroscience of You, and join in with your own questions about neuroscience. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.